In recent years, Idaho education leaders have focused much of their attention on getting more students to graduate college. But how has the once-named Go On campaign been working? In December of 2018, Idaho Education News hosted a forum at Boise State University that assessed the challenges connected with getting more Idahoans to attain some sort of post-secondary degree. Kevin Richard of Idaho Education News moderated this town hall discussion.
My name is Kevin Richard. I'm a reporter with Idaho Education News. We're at idohoednews.org. We are an independent, web-based news site focused on education policy and education politics. For the past 5 months, I've examined this issue for a series of articles titled Obstacles and Options, Building Paths Beyond High School. We published those 8 articles last week. You can find them all at our website. Again, that's idohoednews.org. And along the way, I've had the chance to interview students, educators, and policymakers from all across our state, and several of them are on the stage here with me this evening. I'm really thrilled about the panel we have here this evening. These are folks who live this issue, they're passionate, they're articulate, and I can't wait to get started and let them do the talking. But let me introduce them all to you, and I'm going to start on my left and work my way over. Manuel Garcia comes to us from Twin Falls. He's in his second year at the College of Southern Idaho, where he serves on the Student Senate, and he plans to pursue an MBA. Sonia Olivis is an award-winning teacher from here in Boise. She teaches at Garfield Elementary School, which is one of the city's most diverse schools. Will Overgaard comes to us from Weezer. He's the superintendent of the Weezer School District, and he really, I think, is a good spokesman for the challenges and the innovations that we're seeing in some of the rural schools around our state. Monse Stark comes to us from Moscow. She is with the University of Idaho as Associate Director for Multicultural Admissions. So she's active in student recruiting and student outreach. I'll move to the other side. Debbie Critchfield is a member of the State Board of Education. She's also a spokeswoman for the Cache County School District. So she's going to wear 2 hats here this evening. Tony Rourke is the interim provost here at Boise State University, and he also serves as the vice president for academic affairs. Emily Perez also comes to us from Weezer. She is a senior at Weezer High School. She's her class secretary, and she plans to attend the University of Idaho next fall. And last but not least is Candy Turley Ames, who comes to us from Pocatello. She is the dean of Idaho State University's College of Arts and Letters, and she's been active in trying to recruit rural students. Help me welcome these fine panelists. Before you hear from these panelists, I think it's really important that we put this issue into perspective. So we're going to spend the next 90 seconds showing you a video that gives you some numbers and some facts that we think you need to know.
Studies predict that most Idaho jobs will require a degree or a certificate. After 7 years and $133 million in taxpayer spending, Idaho is unable to convince more high school graduates to continue their education. There are a handful of obstacles. Poverty is the biggest obstacle to attaining a degree. About half of Idaho students qualify for free or reduced-price lunch, a measure of poverty. And Idaho's median household income ranks number 41 in the nation. Idaho's high school graduation rates rank among the worst in the nation, and they are even lower for Hispanic students and those who live in poverty. Idaho's mostly rural landscape makes college less accessible. Most Idaho students live multiple miles from a campus, ranking Idaho number 43 nationally for accessibility. When you consider all adults, very few Hispanics hold a college degree, ranking Idaho last in the nation. And very few Native Americans hold a college degree, ranking Idaho number 42 in the nation. So what's the cost? Taxpayers have helped. Over the past 5 years, Idaho has spent millions on a variety of programs to encourage high school graduates to continue their education. And with financial aid figured in, college is relatively affordable in Idaho. Still, most Idaho college graduates leave school with debt at rates that are among the highest in the West.
Debbie, I'm going to start with you as a member of the State Board. These are the numbers and realities that you've been wrestling with as a panel for several years. How do you change the results when you are faced with some of those demographic realities?
The board revised its strategic plan recently to reflect a more focused goal, a more focused set of goals that would drive us towards some of these outcomes. And as the video clip pointed out, there are a number of factors that whenever we're making decisions, policy changes, initiatives, or looking at other states on how they solve some of these problems, we tick off many of those items that were displayed a few minutes ago. So we look at first generation, and it's not just for Hispanic or for Native students, but how do we tap in to those areas? And we look at programs and initiatives like our direct admissions and making the application process free and streamlining some of those things. We also take a look at the rural nature of our state. And as it was pointed out, the majority of our students live at least 50 miles or more from an actual physical institution, and so access becomes a barrier. And so we look at technology. How can we deliver these things using the technology that we have to have more online offerings to make that more accessible? Now, the other part of the rural nature of our state doesn't just deal with distance. And a lot of times we take a look at how do we impact or affect the culture and expectations of some of our more ag-based communities. And I say that as someone who lives in an ag-based community in a part of our state where that is the industry that supports the county. And culturally, how do we tap into some of those changes and mindsets that going on looks differently for different people? And we use that phrase, and I don't know if it's become a catchphrase or a cliche, but it isn't just about college. And there are a wide variety of ways that the state board is interested in tackling that. One of the data points that was not covered in the video that I don't think has had a lot of attention is the gender disparity for students. And so we know that females at the rate of 52% go on greater than males. And there's a 14% gap there between male and females who choose to do something beyond high school. And that is something that our institutions have brought to us. And across the state, we've looked to see why is that? What are those reasons? And what is it that we can do to help all students? But we believe that that is an interesting data point and characteristic. All of those things, and I've just kind of highlighted a few, are some of the important areas that as a board, when programs and other directives or ideas are brought forward and we're constantly looking for ways that we can capture each of these areas, recognizing that we're not going to get to any of our state goals if it's just about a high school student. We have got to also attract and entice and incentivize those who are currently employed to take a look at things that might enhance their employment. Someone who's maybe underemployed, what skills can we deliver to you that will help you be more successful in those things that you choose?
There's a lot there to follow up
Sorry.
With. But no, that's a great overview. I want to turn to you, Will, as a superintendent in a rural district. When we talked about this a few months ago, you face a lot of the demographics that we're talking about in that video. You're kind of a microcosm in some ways, but the economics really struck me. That there really aren't many jobs in Weezer that require a college education, and there really aren't many families that can afford to make that jump right away. So how do you articulate the goal beyond high school, knowing that college may not be the option for a lot of your students?
All right. Thanks, Kevin. Weezer, Idaho, about 75 miles west here on the border between Oregon along the Snake River, is an ag-based community. About 5,500 in population. It's been that way forever, 60 years or more, that population. And it's not that, people move in, people move out. So it's variable, but it's always been that. The high school's always had about 1,500 kids, and it's always been that way. In Weezer, 50% of our kids are on free and reduced lunch, so there is a high degree of poverty. We have only 11% of the adults age 25 and older that live in the Weezer city limits have a college degree. if you expand that to include the county, it grows to about 15%. Some of those farmers and ranchers that live outside the city limits are college-educated farmers and ranchers. But it's that culture, that expectation, is not really built into the demographics. About a third of our population are Hispanics, and you saw what the results of the poor go-on rates for those, although I'm proud to say that I think some of that's changing, especially in our district. You're going to hear from Emily here, who's a wonderful example of a gal committed to going on and further education when neither of her parents are college educated. And she's made the decision to go on and do that. And we have a number of kids who have done that. Half of the families are below the median. That's why it's the median. It's $31,000. That's family income. And so it makes it difficult for those families to even think about assuming the kind of debt it might take in spite of scholarships or grants. A Pell Grant will get you $6,000 if you're eligible, and that doesn't even cover the cost of tuition at one of our four-year institutions, let alone having to leave Weezer and travel and live and pay your own expenses, etc. So that concerns a lot of families. But I'm proud to say, though, that we still get, in spite of those demographics, our high school staff, our high school administrations made a real concerted effort to provide as many opportunities for kids as possible. So we have a college career counselor who works closely with all our kids. We have a Gear Up program. That's gaining early awareness and readiness for undergraduate programs. It's a federally funded program. And our Gear Up coordinator actually works with a cohort of middle school kids and follows them for 6 years until they graduate. And all those kids are eligible for a Gear Up scholarship upon graduation. And we offer, besides that sort of college preparedness emphasis on part of our counselors, we also have dual credit courses taught by our own staff, quite a number of them actually, and over half our seniors are currently enrolled in a dual credit class. It could be calculus, it could be English 101, it could be environmental science. We have five career and technical programs in our high school. Kids can study ag science, auto mechanics, the construction trades, health occupations. And we're now trying to expand and offer kids an opportunity to work on apprenticeships in the trades. We're trying to provide as many opportunities as we can for kids to do something positive after they get done with their high school program. And one last thing to say is we like to talk about positive placement. We really don't have much other than encouraging kids and helping them prepare for what they do upon graduation. But the go-on rates will be measured by what they do when they're 25 to 34 years old. So what we're trying to do is make sure that there's some sort of positive outcome upon graduation. So we like to count not just the kids who go to a two-year or a four-year or technical school, but we also want to count the kids who go on a mission, which in our community, that's quite a few kids. Up to 5% of the graduating class. 5% of our kids will join the military. And our high school counselors and career and college counselors called every graduate last year, or every last year's graduate this fall to find out where they were. And we found out that they were either enrolled in college or any of those programs, they went on a mission, they joined the military, or we had 14% of our kids who were full-time employed. And so when we talk about did we have a positive go-on rate for our kids, we think 80% is pretty good in a small community with the kind of poverty and the demographics that we have.
Let's hear from our two students next. I'll start with you, Emily. I mean, you've made the decision that you're going to go on to college, and that's the path that you're taking. How did you get there, and how has that process worked with you and with your family?
Well, I always knew that I really wanted to go on and I wanted to go to college, but it was always something that was expected of me, and I think that my parents set up a really good expectation for me, and they really pushed me hard to do what I wanted to do and support me no matter what. And especially, I think, seeing my siblings going on to college and doing, getting their careers, it was kind of, inspiring to me, and I wanted to do that too. But I think that throughout school that I always knew that I wanted to go. I wanted to do something big with my life, and I knew that I wanted to be successful, and I knew that I had to work hard to get what I wanted, and I do. I want to go to college, and I want to, do big things.
Manuel, you're a couple of years further into this process. Was there a turning point, or was there an aha moment for you where you decided, I'm going to do this. I'm going to be a first-generation student.
So for me, it was kind of just like Emily said, I was a first-generation student, a college student. And looking at it, I had no inspiration, no one in my family to look up to. And I had younger siblings who, they're growing up. And for me, it was kind of I wanted to do something bigger. My parent, like I said, my parents, they didn't go to college. They didn't do stuff like that. So it was a pretty big step for me.
One of the things that always struck me, or struck me as I worked on this fall, is the long horizon that we're dealing with in terms of trying to get 25 to 34-year-olds in the workplace with some sort of a post-secondary education. So, Sonia, I want to ask you. I mean, you're in the elementary school level. You're teaching students who are 15, 20 years away from being in that 25 to 34-year-old cohort, that work cohort. How do you try to get those students prepared, and how do you kind of overcome some of the demographic challenges that you see within your own school?
Sure. Yeah, I'm in the trenches, baby. It's it's happening. And I have a foot in both camps because I teach at the elementary school level, but then I also teach at Boise State. I continually have an eye on the present, on my 10-year-olds, but then also an eye on the future and our next generation of our teachers that are going to be. And so when I hear about the efforts that are being made and the challenges that exist at the high school level to be able to have a go-on rate and then, of course, meeting the 60% goal, for me, I just think if we do not start building capacity for that identity of a go-on ambition in elementary, we are missing the boat, folks. We cannot start thinking in high school we need to start pumping these kids and heading them in the direction of a post-secondary or a professional certificate. That conversation needs to happen when they are 6, 7, 8, and you better believe in fifth grade we're talking about it. What is it that we want to do? What is it that your dreams entail? And I feel strongly that if we're going to start developing that identity, to do it without the help of the family is missing the biggest opportunity of our lifetime. So as a fifth grade teacher, I teach everything, right? So 7 subjects every day, integrated, and we make it work. But my passion and heart surrounds STEM education with our underrepresented populations and our low income and our high ethnic minority and our poor schools. And so when I look at the statistics of, the gaps that are out there and where the jobs are, did you notice the icons they use for the jobs that are needed in Idaho and how many of them are STEM related? The gaps that exist because they are opportunity gaps. There is no gap in the capacity or the potential or the ability to be able to do those things. Our kids absolutely can do anything if they have the opportunity and that facilitation early on with the involvement of the family. So the research that I'm looking at says that kids develop a STEM identity, an identity between ages 10 and 14. So by the time they go to junior high, they already have it in their head, hey, math is for me, science is for me. And intuitively, they would have it in their head, hey, college is for me, already by the time they're going into that junior high setting. So what are we doing early on to start shifting that language of possibility that, hey, bud, this is for you and here's why? And then involving the family in that discussion and shifting the identity also of the family, when the family sees it as a possibility, that transfers to the child. That notion of habitus, our set of expectations and experiences that shape the way we view the world, starts at home. So when we work with our families and that notion of that trifecta of school, home, community, that's when we get some work done, because the kids are able to work with the family, with the school, in the community, saying, hey, everybody's got my best interest in mind. And I am able to go on. I am able to see that there are resources and people that are going to help me all the way through. And that work starts when they are little.
Monse, one of the numbers that I encountered when I was putting this together that really, really surprised me, there were state board numbers, the go-on rates, the gap in go-on rates between white students and Latino students, it's 4 percentage points. It's a gap, but it's not a very wide gap. But the completion rate gap is 26 percentage points. What's happening there, and how much of that is affordability, or are there other factors in that mix?
I'm going to echo Sonia's comment. I think it has to do with the fact that the family hasn't been involved throughout this whole process. It's the fact that students are still in the back of their minds thinking, are my parents okay? Are they financially secure? Do I need to go back and help them? Or if their parents call them and say, hey, you know, whether there's been a divorce or whether one of the parents has lost their job, it's up to the student, or at least the student feels like they're responsible for their family. And as the oldest in my family, that's how I felt. And as I went through school, every single day I kept wondering, do I need to quit to go help my family? And I see a lot of you shaking your head. And this is for all of our students, not even just for our Latino students. But sometimes that family, that community, and everything that they've gone through since they were born, they can't get rid of that. They don't see as, sometimes we actually don't even see students going on to four-year institutions because they want to stay close to families. But yet that rate goes down for graduation because they end up going back home and helping their students and end up working full-time, and then their grades go down. So once that happens, it is very hard for that student to continue or to even get up those grades. And so the support services that are available at the Bureau of Universities are so important, and sometimes as families, we need to remind our students, hey, there are support services, go and help them. But without the family's help and reminder every single day, they're not going to do it on their own. And for those who are doing it on their own, it is very, very tough. A lot of our students that do graduate end up graduating, but their GPA isn't the greatest because they have so many things in their minds that they have to think about. It's not just their education.
I want to ask a couple of questions about affordability, and I feel like, again, these are questions that I feel like I want to start with the students. Manuel, you're working part-time. You're also living in your hometown as you're going to college. But you're looking at going on from junior college and going to graduate school. How are you preparing for that transition and the financial implications of what awaits?
So when I first started, I had plans of going to BSU at the beginning, but it kind of fell through. And I knew I wanted to go to college. So CSI was a pretty good choice because it was already in my town. And I was able to get scholarships, so I got that full year paid for this year and last year. So affordability is pretty important. And just kind of looking for scholarships, but even then, like, I know people, some of my other classmates with scholarships, it's kind of tough. But it was, balancing everything has definitely been a big struggle for me. But I definitely like being involved and definitely doing, pushing myself and pushing myself like that has definitely, like, not just helped me, but inspired others, because I've noticed while I'm doing what I'm doing, I see other people, like, asking me questions about how'd you get that scholarship, or what'd you do to do that.
Emily, when we spoke back for the series in the fall, you talked about you took several dual credit classes, or you're taking dual credit classes now. How important is that in trying to, you know, thread the needle in terms of making college affordable and feasible?
Having that opportunity of having dual credit classes has really helped me, because I know that when I go to college, it's going to be, you know, a less of a load for me to, you know, I won't have to take as many classes. I'll have most of the general is already taken care of, which is a really good thing, and it's going to make it college, you know, more affordable for me. So I think that was probably one of my best decisions, you know, going through high school and taking advantage of those dual credit opportunities, so because I knew it was going to help me in the long run.
And I'm going to stay on the end of the table. Candy, this is a good chance to get you involved here, because this is an issue for ISU, not just about dual credit in terms of allowing students to earn some credits. It's about getting students introduced to the campus setting. Talk a little bit about what's going on at ISU and what you're seeing in terms of results there.
Yeah, thank you, Kevin. At ISU, it's been very interesting. You know, in many ways, I think of ISU and our service region as being all rural. I think I could argue that, even our larger cities. And as dean of the College of Arts and Letters and as a longtime faculty member at ISU, I've cared very much about helping students find their path to ISU and to actually complete. And those are hard things to accomplish in rural America. I would argue that the State Board of Education and the legislature has done a fabulous job of presenting students with opportunities and access. They've done a great job of supporting those initiatives. I think what the universities need to figure out how to do better, and maybe with some support as well, particularly in rural areas, is to figure out how to catch those students, if you will, on the other end. So I look at our career and college readiness counselors. Phenomenal people. They work very hard, along with administrators, to help students see the opportunities that are available to them and to encourage them and support them. Same with the advanced opportunity funding. Tremendous amount of resources put into supporting students in earning college credit and dual enrollment. But on the other end of things, the university is often viewed as this ivory tower. And it's more than just pushing and encouraging students. On the other end of things, us as administrators, teachers, passionate educators, it's about us finding ways to help those students come to the university setting and to feel supported. And I think that's a lot harder in rural areas. I think students come with a lack of confidence. They certainly don't have as many role models, and they really struggle. What we have been doing at Idaho State University is trying to figure out what is the companion set of resources that students need once they start to take that first step. So they've taken a dual enrollment course in their high school. How do we get them from there to on campus and to be successful? And I wish I could say that our dual enrollment classes in the high school are enough to provide that kind of encouragement and confidence. But what I'm finding is getting students on campus, spending time with them, providing them, if you will, with the CCA, so the Career and College Readiness resource, on campus to support those students once they come. Idaho State University is not a large campus compared to Boise State, but we do have a quad. And I have watched rural student after rural student come to ISU, and we tell them that the financial aid office is over there. And they start to walk halfway across the quad, and they think, I don't know that I'm ready to meet that next new person and share something so personal. And instead of walking to the financial aid office or the business office, they walk back to their car. So it has been my passion to make sure that those students don't leave campus once they come and that we find a way to support them as they make all of these decisions. So we've created a series of programs, one where our faculty are spending more time in the high schools developing relationships with students, parents, administrators, and that seems to be helping us. We have some wonderful data that show that that's indeed the case, and our high school teachers should be our biggest advocates and our partners in this. So we've been doing that. We've also been working on scholarships that target those students who are ready for college but may not necessarily be the National Merit Scholar.
So a lot of what the state is spending is predicated on trying to get students onto the campus, whether it's the dual credit classes or scholarship funding or college and career advisors at the high school level. But let's talk a little bit about when the students get onto the campus and keeping students on track and on schedule. And Tony, I want to go to you about this, about the retention front. I mean, what are you doing at Boise State? I know there are a lot of innovative programs at Boise State on the retention front. And are they specifically done with, you know, first-generation students or rural students or students from low-income backgrounds, or are they done with those students in mind?
Thanks, Kevin. Yes, they are done with those target populations in mind, and it seems to me that we probably want to divide some of the typical academic challenges that all students face, but maybe some students feel more acutely than others. And those we've found are often associated with underpreparedness. We do have a very robust dual career program and offerings in Idaho, and students are taking advantage of those. But despite the fact that these courses that are offered, at least in our delivery model, these courses that are offered in the high school are academically equivalent to the course that's offered here on campus, the setting really is entirely different. And if you were to walk into a high school building, you'd be very hard-pressed to distinguish the dual-credit classrooms from the sort of traditional classrooms. And so that social setting really makes quite a difference. So when a student arrives on campus and may have accumulated some dual credits and therefore has banked some credits and is that much closer to the finish line, they may not be emotionally or socially prepared to adjust their weekly schedule and wrap their mind around attending class just two or three times a week and having the kind of freedom and responsibility that comes with that less structured schedule than they have in the high school where they're going to class every day, just like every other class. So getting back to many students come to us with ideas about being an engineer, going on into med school. These are fantastic. We do not have any kinds of hurdles, artificial hurdles that would prevent a student who has those goals from achieving those. It's common, I would say, for a number of universities, especially very selective ones, to screen students and say, if you don't have a certain test score, if you don't have a certain GPA, if you don't perform up to certain standards here on campus, you'll have to choose another major. We can't support you in achieving your goal of becoming an engineer. So we do have students who are coming to us whose preparation in mathematics is not at the calculus level. They're not calculus ready. They haven't taken calculus in high school. And what we found was that for those students, it was often precisely the so-called remediation courses that would serve as an impediment for them making progress. And it wasn't that the students aren't capable, and it wasn't that the curriculum wasn't structured in a way that they could make it through. It was the very notion of a remedial course becomes a significant psychological impediment to being successful. It essentially signals to the student, you're incapable of doing this. So even though our practice and our overt language was inclusive and welcoming and encouraging and supportive, the curricular structure was not sending that same message. And so one of the initiatives that's coming out of the State Board Office, and one that we really support and think we've made some progress in, is what we call co-remediation. And so instead of segregating students and placing them in a course that has a number like 090, it's not a 100-level course, so even the number has a stigma attached to it, not giving them any credit for it, because it's not a college course after all, that's the traditional thinking, and maybe even charging them extra money for taking it, we've said that isn't going to work anymore. It clearly doesn't work. It is demonstrably a failure, actually, in helping students to progress through our curriculum. So instead, why don't we think about those aspects of the course that we would have had them take under the old model and see if we can't incorporate that into a proper introductory course for engineers, let's say, so that they're actually getting that content, that training, and that mindset simultaneously with the material that we might have judged them to be unprepared for. And as it turns out, students are wildly successful when you give them this opportunity. And it's actually sort of surprising if you think about it a priori that a student who, on paper at any rate, is not prepared to be successful in a particular course will be successful in that course, provided that you have some additional adjunct form of support and challenge, actually. So it's putting the student to the challenge and putting the challenge to the student. But we need someone who can do that and help the student make it to the financial aid office and help the student find employment on campus or off campus and figure out what kind of student groups might be appropriate. And if they don't live on campus, think about those opportunities to engage with their peers in ways that are possible and meaningful, such that they actually feel like they belong on campus. And that's a very difficult challenge. I don't propose that we have solved that challenge yet.
Okay, thank you. We've spent a lot of time talking about college and going on to college, but the 60% goal is not that simple, and it's much more inclusive than college. It involves professional certificates and CTE. So I want to segue into that a little bit, and I want to start with you, Will, about how you see that in the continuum, as you talked about before, about trying to make sure that students have good outcomes, whatever those outcomes are, in whatever form. Talk a little bit about how CTE fits into that and maybe some of the obstacles a rural district faces in providing CTE.
Thanks, Kevin. I want to start by recognizing and thanking, you know, Debbie and the State Board and also the legislature for putting money into college and career readiness initiatives. There's more discussion about going on and what your possibilities are after high school throughout the state now than there ever has been. So that's we appreciate that across the state as administrators. Our goal is to make sure that every kid, we meet with every student, we're able to because we have 500 kids in our high school. We have two academic counselors. We have a gear up coordinator and a college career counselor. And our two administrators meet with every student every year and talk about their four-year plan, talk about what they've accomplished, what their goals are, if it's changing, to give them some advice on kinds of courses they might consider. They can guide them into the correct sort of course sequence they might want to take. But like I mentioned earlier, we try and offer and have always offered those career and technical fields. We probably don't have as good a job of helping those kids move from those career and technical, if they're a completer in that program, is moving on either to a technical school that's related to that or into a two- or a four-year program where they can continue their study or their practice of those skills. But we have always offered as complete a career and technical along with our, you know, our core academic. So the ag science is a really successful program for us. That's your FFA kids, and a lot of those kids will go on to college. But we offer it as to expose kids to the science of agriculture that live in an ag community. But our auto mechanics program, we have kids that can be directly placed into work in the area, or they'll choose to go to another technical field, or they're just doing it so they can work on their own cars. How's that? Our health oc, we can introduce kids to and help them complete a CNA program, or we can introduce them to emergency medical technician field and give them some EMT basic courses and encourage them to go on. We have a building trades where our building trades instructor, we're not as sophisticated as they are in maybe the more urban areas where they go out and build houses, but we build shops, and so kids can learn the basics of construction, cement work, wiring, plumbing, on smaller projects in the area and get exposed to that. And then what am I missing there? Our individualized occupational training, where if a kid has a desire to maybe be a veterinary, to go into the veterinary science or something, we can get them a work experience off campus where they can go do that. Or if they're interested in education, we can match them up with a teacher and so on. So we're trying to get, and then I also mentioned that we're looking at apprenticeship programs, which we need the people in the trades out in the rural areas. We're seeing old businesses that provided electrical, plumbing. Our HVAC company has been at me for years to try and help them find potential workers. That's what led us to create the apprenticeship program, and we want to do that into the other trades. So we're always looking in those more technical trade fields to give kids to pursue options that they can get a good-paying job, still live in the community, take care of their families. And so that's our approach to the CTE aspect of our post-secondary placements.
And Debbie, I'm going to turn to you, and now you get to wear your Cache County district hat. You all have started, it's a unique apprenticeship program. You had to go through some unique hoops to make it happen to get students in food processing plants on an apprenticeship basis. But at the same time, I mean, it would provide some high school graduates with a job right out of high school and a good job, but it doesn't get us any closer to the 60% because it's not post-secondary certification. Do you have mixed feelings about that as a state board member? And, is it hard to wear the state board hat and the Cache County district hat? Walk us through the apprenticeship program, how it works, and how it fits into the 60%.
About 3 years ago, there were some individuals who owned some manufacturing plants that came to the local Department of Labor and said, we have a need. We would like to essentially grow our own. We feel that we've got a base here, and particularly in the Magic Valley right now, it really is a manufacturing hub around the state, and we're seeing significant growth in that area. And they weren't able to fill the jobs, and I think that is a representation around the state of either what's here or what's to come in other areas. And we've got two school districts who also have technical centers. Why is it that we can't attract students into some of these careers? And so the Department of Labor took that on and came to both school districts and said, look, these businesses, they don't want to do two separate programs. You need to work together and figure out a way that we can accomplish this. And over time, it took about close to 2 years to go through some fairly rigorous federal requirements to get a federally recognized, it's a certified apprenticeship to work program, and the federal part came in because we needed to get permission to have 16-year-olds operate or be around equipment. And through that process, they developed a curriculum that was a machine operator apprenticeship, again, first in the nation for that particular field that was going to be supported locally and with some federal dollars. The instructors' pay came from businesses who were going to be the recipients of the students who were that motivated and that passionate about it. And it meets at a 0 hour. It happens to meet at the Technical Center in Minidoka County. And they keep similar work standards that you would find in a place of business. So many absences and you're not in the program anymore. You've got to keep that up. The expectation is that students will be on time and, again, be thorough and be responsible. Now, the promise to the student after the first year is that they will have summer employment that that is around the $15 an hour range, which is a good summer job for a high school student. And then the second year is if you successfully complete that program, then you would have a job at one of these places. So last year was the first year of the program, and so we've just finished, or we're just starting this year, the group that will be in their second year of the program. And last year I sat at a table. They had a big dinner, and they invited students to come and their parents, and they wanted to talk about it and really showcase the efforts that had been made by both of the school districts. And I happened to be seated at a table with a gentleman and his son, and I wasn't, being like creepy and overhearing them, but they were sitting right next to me, and so I could hear what they were talking about. And the father was telling his son, hey, don't mess this up. This is a great opportunity for you. I wish that I would have had this opportunity when I was your age. To be able to get into this path and get into this track. And just listening to that interaction between father and son and the expectation of the parent, and I don't think we can overemphasize the value of an adult, a trusted adult in a student's life to help guide them down a good path. And I saw that, and I saw that son listening to his father, and certainly, I mean, I felt like I wanted to cheer him on too. I just was so taken by the interaction. And we're seeing students that are successful in this in the fall. And Kevin, I know you came down and interviewed a couple of students from the program. There are certain competencies that the students had to take similar to any of the other employees. You're there 90 days, you need to pass this test before you can do this. You're there 60 days, you need to pass this. Well, the employees have an opportunity, if they want, to take the 60 and the 90-day test at the 30-day mark. If they think that they're prepared to do that. And so both of the students opted to do that. They thought, what the heck? And some of the more experienced and established employees kind of said, I don't know if that's a good idea. You might want to wait until you've been here a little bit longer. And they were very enthusiastic and felt good about themselves. And anyway, they both reported that they had passed all the competencies leading up, you know, that they needed for that whole year within the first few weeks of being at the school. And so they felt being at work. So they felt as though the program and the training and the curriculum, all of those things were there to support the student.
Okay. Well, let's start with some questions from the audience. I think we have an audience member who's been waiting to ask a question.
So earlier there was a claim made that there's not obstacles in place keeping students from getting their degree. Well, I'm a student in the College of Ed, and I've been accepted into the education program, but before I could do that, I had to pay an application fee to get into the program. Before I could do that, I had to spend hundreds of dollars on praxis exams to be able to get into the program. I even had to do an interview where I was denied the first time because my answers were too rigid for the board. I've had colleagues, friends, who have been told that they didn't get in because their answers weren't passionate enough. So I guess my question is, those are hurdles that we have to overcome. I spent $600 taking praxis exams this year on top of tuition, which I pay out of pocket working part-time. And I am one of those students who lives 50 miles away from campus. I commute to Boise 3 days a week, sometimes five, depending on when classes are offered. So what is being done about eliminating these hurdles that aren't there to begin with?
I think that's a good question for you, Tony.
I think that's to me. So. Thank you. Yes, right. You've got the Bronco gear on. So, well, first, I want to commend you for your perseverance, your persistence, and it's paying off, I think, clearly. I hope I didn't say something to suggest that we were eliminating all obstacles or that we've been successful even in eliminating the obstacles which can be legitimately eliminated. We work on those constantly, and we still have work to do, no doubt. There are some requirements that are either mandated by the state for certification, for example, in terms of taking the praxis and being recommended to the State Department of Education for certification to teach, that are really not optional for us. And so in the College of Education, the posture is, we will make sure that it's administered in a way that's consistent with the guidelines that we are subject to, but also in a way that helps students to develop. I can't comment on, because I don't know any of the details behind your personal experience, but my clear impression in working with my colleagues in the College of Education, and I suspect that this is true at the other colleges and universities, is that they are deeply committed to preparing teachers for the profession to be successful, and that they have a number of tools in their toolkit that cut in different directions for different students. So one student may find a particular requirement in being admitted to or in completing the program to be particularly challenging and onerous, while another student might find that one to be relatively simple. And the situation might be flipped for some other requirement. And so students' experiences do vary quite a lot, and we recognize that. And I hope that my colleagues and the professors and administrators and staff in the College of Education are sensitive to the kinds of challenges and issues that you've identified to make sure that there isn't any unnecessary burden that's there. There is a financial implication, no doubt, and those add up. And I think it's probably too easy for people like me to sit at a table like this and say, well, it's only $50. But that's $50, and it's added on top of the $150 that you paid last week and the $225 that you paid last month, and it really does add up and it really makes a difference. And so I want to acknowledge that as being true and very important. I have an obligation to kind of understand how all of these pieces fit together and to think about, where are the opportunities for us to reduce the friction? It can't go away completely, but can we be purposeful about where we don't have any option, either because it's a state requirement or a federal requirement, or genuinely in students' best interest that we have some particular standard that has to be met? And where are we just sort of shooting ourselves in the foot and making things unnecessarily difficult for our students? I have no doubt that we do that, and I have pretty clear ideas about where we need to improve on that. I'm sure that there are areas where we do that that are outside my field of view and that I'm just ignorant of. I need to understand those and work with colleagues and likewise across institutions with the state board as well as on this individual campus to reduce the friction where we can.
Thank you.
Hi, thanks for putting this on. I know we're talking about building paths beyond high school, but given that children who are not literate by fourth grade end up really never catching up, and given the evidence that especially for disadvantaged children, pre-K provides myriad benefits for their success and the success of the whole community. Do you foresee offering a pre-K program that would be public and therefore free to the public? And if so, how would you see that funded? Maybe Debbie or anyone who would like to answer.
Who wants to talk about pre-K?
We need it. Yeah. I want to give a shout out, and I'll stop because I know this twice in a row.
No, rude of me.
No. During the series, Kevin, you talked about the community schools program, and you were talking about the programs that are in Vancouver.
Yes.
That community-centered education, and I wanted to say that the Boise School District has the pilot program for community schools, and we're a couple years in, and that we have 5 community schools where they're addressing all of the needs of the family. So not only addressing food scarcity, clothing, but part of the early reading program is a part of that, getting pre-K, because we know the research is there, right? That
if we can... Pilot pre-K programs in the Vista neighborhoods.
Right? Exactly. So the Boise School District is doing that right now because we know the outcomes are going to pay off huge. But it's also addressing that there are multifaceted needs of the family and of the child that start before they even get into the school building. And so I'd love to hear from our state board and what are we going to do long term over for the entire state of Idaho. So Boise Schools is piloting it, but what's our plan for the future?
Let me give you sort of the rural school district response to that sort of issue. We would love, I think, and I know a number of superintendents would love to see full-time kindergarten funded before we go down and reach down into preschool. Now, some districts have the resources to either their local taxpayers are paying supplemental funds to provide it, or they found a way to do it. But I was talking to the superintendent from Jerome the other day, and we were talking about that. Now, his district is more than twice our size, but his issues would be the same. We would have to double the staffing, and we'd have to find facilities to house additional location for even just the kindergarten to offer full-time or full-day kindergarten. What he does in his district is similar to what we do is as kids start kindergarten, we find out that they're are not progressing at a quick enough pace or with their peers, we will invite some of those kids, a small number of them, to attend the alternate session, which increases the class size for that kindergarten teacher, but as long as we stay under 20 and can keep it at about 18, our teachers are okay with that. So we try and target those kids, and they're doing that in Jerome as well. And then after a period of time, if they show progress, they'll move those kids out and take the next kids who might benefit from that. But from a realistic standpoint, we would really like to see full-time kindergarten as opposed before we get into pre-K. I will tell you, we built a new early childhood resource center 2 years ago, and we brought our special ed kids and our special ed preschool kids and all of our primary grade special ed kids under the same roof. They were in an outbuilding. We brought them under the same roof as as our other primary age kids, and we took that outbuilding and we donated it, or we're allowing Head Start to access that, and they are a preschool program, because our kids in Weezer for about the last 6 years for preschool were being put on buses and transported to Payette 15 miles away, 3- and 4-year-olds, believe that or not. So we now can offer Head Start in our facility because we were able to add on to our existing facility to serve special ed kids.
Pre-K, all full-day kindergarten?
Last year, the State Board with the State Department, we put out for, you know, statewide for families a free online, recognizing that that wasn't the silver bullet of, oh, look what, we put this out there and now we're done. We know that this is an important issue. Early education readiness at every grade begins right at the beginning, and I know that we recognize that and appreciate that. We've had more as a board, that's the we I'm referring to, we have had more groups and individuals come to us and say, can we do some type of a hybrid? Can we leverage what's going on in communities and in other ways and do that? And the answer is yes. However, we know that others are looking for a more uniform and consistent statewide approach that does take in state funding. And with coming changes to K-12 funding, I don't know, and I know Wendy Horman's here, and I'm not going to put her on the spot to explain that, if that allows some more flexibility within local budgets to provide some of those things if it's needed. However, I know that the conversation is to a point where state board members are being solicited to say, we need to have the conversation, and we need to have some type of consensus on how we go and present to the legislature and to other policymakers on how we can really address this need that I think everyone recognizes is a need. How do we solve it?
I'm going to ask the final question, and I think it's fitting that we hear from the students and give them the final word here. I mean, Manuel and Emily, you're a few years away from being in that 25 to 34-year-old cohort that we keep talking about, you know, adults who we hope complete some post-secondary education. You're both looking at college or attending college. What are we not understanding about the world from where you see it, where you sit at your age?
Like, for me, I'm Hispanic, so I have a little bit of a different, like, grow up, when, how I grew up and stuff. So understanding that, and I have assignments due and stuff like that, and sometimes if you don't, like, turn it in, you might have had, like, a family issue. Like, for me, I have a really big family, and sometimes that, like, bothers, like, takes place of, like, of my studies and stuff like that.
Emily, what are we missing here from your point of view?
I think that, well, for me personally, what I've heard a lot tonight is, you know, having that support system, and, you know, especially from your family and from your teachers and the people that are around you. So I think that may be something, because I know a lot of students, they probably don't have a family that really, you know, supports them, or they feel like their teachers don't really care. And I feel like I've been lucky enough to, you know, have a supporting family and have teachers and, you know, have a school that really does care, and they'll help me if I need help. And so I think that maybe that's one thing, is having that support system is one of the most important things, and I think that's what a lot of students might be missing out on.
We could do this for another 2 hours. This is a great panel. Please help me thank these folks for taking the time out to share their stories.
You have been listening to a town hall forum from Idaho Education News, recorded at Boise State University in December of 2018 and brought to you by Boise State Public Radio. To hear this special conversation or for more reporting on educational standards, initiatives, and efforts in Idaho, go to boisestatepublicradio.org, click the news tab, and select Education.